Hey, everyone, it's Steve Miller in Washington. Thank you so much for joining me on Friday, the 10th of June, for VOA's Asia Weekly podcast. Now, coming up in this episode, smartphones have penetrated nearly every aspect of our lives. And as a result, we're spending more and more time on them, using them to connect with one another on social media sites. But what effect is it having on our society? Plus, Philippine President-elect Rodrigo Duterte continues making controversial remarks, while at the same time promises a metamorphosis upon his inauguration. Is he hurting the Philippines' national image? But first, China says it won't back down from its position on the South China Sea, prompting some to wonder, is another Cold War brewing? It's dubbed the Shangri-La Dialogue, the largest annual defense security forum in Asia. And like last year's meeting, the competing claims in the South China Sea topped the agenda. Now, in a session entitled Managing South China Sea Tensions, People's Liberation Army Major General Yao Yunju blasted back at the United States and others by saying no state had the right to impose its own understanding of freedom of navigation as a universal rule and label those who do not agree as a default violator. United States Secretary of Defense Ash Carter warned China that its actions may be contributing to a Great Wall of Isolation after a year of building outposts on reclaimed land in disputed waters. Broadcaster Channel News Asia sat down with the secretary and asked him if the area was turning into a site of a new Cold War. He responded by saying, the U.S. is not seeking any kind of Cold War or a separation or confrontation in the region. Okay then, but what is a Cold War? Well, I spoke with Stratfor's East Asia analyst, Thomas Vien, and he says a Cold War was a
comprehensive just power struggle between the U.S. and the Soviet Union that basically spilled over into everything. And I would say that if you look at the U.S.-China relationship today, there's obviously characterized by a significant amount of cooperation, you know, economically and other things like that.
Then, using that as our definition, are we there yet? Vien says
this might be an intransigent matter in the South China Sea, but I would hesitate to use Cold War. I mean, people are saying that this is because China will not abide by the upcoming ruling from the Court of Arbitration, but I don't think anyone expected them to either. For them, they've spent the last 2 weeks making it very clear that it is not something that they'll play ball with, and they're very steadfast in this. And the U.S., for its part, is very steadfast in, you know, really saying we don't agree that that's how we should define the rights to these waters.
In fact, he thinks China and the United States want to avoid a Cold War on the scale that the world saw between the United States and the Soviet Union, even if those two nations can't come to an agreement over the South China Sea. But listening to China discuss the dispute, Beijing doesn't articulate a scenario where the area isn't their sovereign territory. With that in mind, what direction can the discussions take?
Both China and the U.S. know that this administration, the Obama administration, has a very, very limited amount of time in the office. So that's kind of a big question mark because, you know, you don't have a whole lot of room to negotiate on anything. The Chinese are not assured that any deals that they strike with the U.S. can be respected by the next Congress, the next administration. So there's not a whole lot of wiggle room right now. And just like moving forward, like beyond even 2017, just what's the long-term solution? I think that both sides have been very clear that they don't necessarily see this as something where you strike a grand bargain and then it's done.
Essentially, looking at China's desire to remain in control and the U.S.'s interest in maintaining access to the South China Sea, Vien says there just isn't a magic bullet that can resolve things. He says it's about managing the situation long term. But that's the U.S. and China. We're talking about two superpowers here. What about the other claimants? The Philippines and Vietnam have both been very vocal in their opposition to China's claim. What can they do? According to Vien, he says it's important to look beyond 2017.
But they're in a position where they understand that China is not going away. They understand that the U.S. is not going away either, even though the direction of its exact policy is not certain at the moment. So they kind of just have to be in this uncomfortable position in which they had to hedge their bets. They can't go all in on saying, well, we'll oppose China on the sea claims when they're not sure how the U.S. is going to react, at least in the short term. If you look at Vietnam on the edges of the Shangri-La dialogue, in the bilateral conversation between Admiral Sun Jianguo, the head Chinese delegate, and the Vietnamese actually they said, you want to boost cooperation, we want to talk about doing search and rescue exercises together, and maybe we'll let your ships pass through one of our naval facilities. And this has been, in Chinese state media interpreted this as Camran Bay. So even the Vietnamese, who are possibly the most vocal and the most capable of China's rivals in the South China Sea, have to be in this position where they aren't going all in.
Now, another tidbit of information that's been making the rounds recently has been the notion that China may declare an Air Defense Identification Zone, or ADIZ, over the South China Sea. This is something Beijing has already done over the East China Sea. So what have we learned from that, and how has it affected the region?
I don't know if this has necessarily disrupted normal traffic to the area.
Vian says that the declaration is more about shaping future dialogue more than anything else. So really, what does this all mean? Well, Stratfor's Thomas Vian doesn't foresee any large-scale escalation, and while there may be little blips here and there in the future, ultimately,
strategically, this is an impasse.
He also notes that a certain degree of uncertainty exists about who's going to be in the White House next year, and anything China does in the region risks making what's going on in the South China Sea part of the national discussion during the U.S. election, meaning it's something Beijing would have to look at and weigh the consequences of to determine if it's worth pursuing. It seems no matter where you go in the world today, someone out there has a smartphone in their hand, even prompting some countries around the world to create texting-only walking lanes because people are so glued to their devices that they aren't paying attention to their surroundings. While technology researcher Gartner sees global smartphone sales slowing, the penetration of these devices into mature markets around the world stands at about 90%. And in a study last year in South Korea, they found that of the 1,000 students surveyed, 25% felt that they were addicted to the devices, and as a whole, spent an average of 5.4 hours every single day on them. And you have to wonder, are those outlying figures, or are they representative of life in the digital age? Data and Society Research Institute's Amanda Lenhart has studied teens, relationships, and technology. According to her findings,
majority of, at least Americans, are using social media sites and using them quite frequently. Adolescents in particular, which is sort of my area of focus, really do use social media. And it's a quite important part of how teenagers kind of create their social worlds. So it's really quite a critical space for many adolescents for interacting with others.
Lenhart notes that for many teens, a seamless transition exists between conversations that take place face-to-face and those that are online. In fact, she feels they
play an important role in how teens communicate, how they know what's happening in their friends' lives, where they gather social support when they're having difficult times, where they display themselves and their relationships with to other people, whether that's a romantic relationship that they want to sort of show off to their community and their network of peers, or simply sort of the way they present themselves as people.
Lenhart says that teens may also differentiate on how teens use various social media platforms, meaning that one account may be open to everyone, while another may be restricted. And you know what? That makes sense because, well, even I do that. I have a personal Facebook account for my family and a public page for all the world to see. So with smartphones penetrating so much of the world market, how much time is being spent on these devices? Lenhart says that with American teens,
we now see that about a quarter of teens say they spend their time, they're almost constantly online, an enormous percentage, more than 80% of teens, say they're online every day. And a lot of that's because you now have this computing power in your pocket. You have, this computer that connects you to your friends and to information at your disposal literally every moment of the day. And so I think that contributes to this increase that we see in this kind of access.
Okay, so now that we have a baseline for how much time is spent on these smartphone devices and how they're used to communicate with one another, how are they used for interpersonal relationships? Lenhart says that only a small fraction of American teens have found a romantic partner online, whereas more than half have made a friend through digital platforms. However, Lenhart doesn't think online communication is necessarily critical in the meeting phase.
it's definitely critical in the flirting phase, in the expressing interest part of a relationship. There's also a little bit about display, that you want to use these sites to show and show off that you like this person, to tell them publicly that you care for them, and to show your friends and family that this is something that, that this is someone who's important to you. And so, you know, there's lots of rituals that teens create around what you're supposed to do. And they obviously differ from different groups, but maybe they involve particular emojis that you place in your profile so that people know that you're taken, and other types of rituals around photos and sharing of information and sharing of images that, you know, teens use to signal this kind of experience to their friends and peers.
So, is spending so much time online affecting our society? Data and Society Research Institute's Amanda Lenhart believes that's simply where we spend our time.
That's what our third space is, where teens can spend time together. At least in the United States, for many teens, they don't have as many opportunities to sort of spend time informally with friends in person. It's hard to get together. People live and don't always live close by, and don't always have access to public transportation or parent transportation. And so it can be challenging to find ways to get together with your friends, particularly those who don't live near you. And so, you know, with that, I mean, these online spaces become this so-called third place where you can go and meet other people in the ways that coffee shops and cafes and bars and other kinds of places in our world serve that purpose for adults and for youth. These digital spaces can become that other place that's not work, that's not school, that's not home, where you can gather and spend time with people and exchange ideas, in some ways bring all the challenges that you have in the rest of your life into that same digital space.
But, Lenhart notes,
well, I think the lines are blurred for a lot of people, particularly depending on how their social networks are kind of built online. I would say, though, that, you know, finding a balance is something that I think is dependent on the person. You know, in the research world, you know, we've been starting to talk about this idea of differential susceptibility, that, you know, to return to your sort of our previous conversation about addiction, that that there is some suggestion that for some people, spending a lot of time online isn't particularly healthy, just in the same way that for some people, you know, drinking alcohol isn't healthy and isn't something that's kind of controllable or manageable in their lives. But that not everybody has that experience, and that for some people, spending a lot of time online is great. It's helpful. It's useful. Maybe they're shy and don't have a hard time talking with people in person, but really blossom in the digital context.
And other people, she says, really don't get much out of communicating online and prefer being out in the so-called real world. So where do you fall in? For me, as much as I like connecting with people around the globe and maintaining friendships across the ocean, I equally love unplugging and getting away from it all. Throughout the Philippines presidential campaign, Rodrigo Duterte was no stranger to controversy since becoming the president-elect, and hasn't stopped. First, he said corrupt journalists deserve to die, and has now told Filipinos that they have the option of calling the police or taking up a gun to rout out drug dealers from their own neighborhoods, going as far as to say he would give citizens medals for killing criminals. Such comments have brought about a lot of criticism from organizations like the United Nations, Human Rights Watch, and Reporters Without Borders. It's also prompted Mr. Duterte to cancel all press conferences for now, saying he will simply disseminate information through press releases to avoid any kind of error. Mr. Duterte also claims that upon taking the oath of office on June 30th, he will undergo a transformation and will no longer be the foul-mouthed person we see today. But how likely is that, given what we've seen during his tenure as mayor? Or does it even really matter? Dr. Patricio Abinales is the director of Philippine Studies at the University of Hawaii at Manila. He says that while Duterte may want to institute some of the same policies that helped transform the city of Davao from the murder capital of the Philippines, the president-elect may run into problems. But for those that live in Davao, he says,
That is how he always operated them. I used to listen to his Sunday talk show. He has a Sunday talk show with this incredible title called From the Masses to the Masses. It's so competes with the morning Sunday morning sermons of the Catholic Church. And in from 8 to 9 every morning, he says the same things we've been saying now. Curses at everybody, tells this person that he's a drug lord, that he's a piece of druggie, and you better be careful about this. You know, I'll go kill everybody. I mean, there's just curses and curses every day. But that's a Sunday morning prayer for most of the people from Davao. So for the people of Davao, this is not new. This is what he is. This is what he's been. But he's also known as, you know, the benevolent mayor. You know, go out of his way to help people.
In essence,
he hasn't learned how to talk at the national leader. I think he's still in transition. He hasn't figured it out. So he slips into that. He slips into this Sunday morning mayor talk show, cursing everybody mode.
Richard Haydarian is a political science professor at Manila's De La Salle University. He says now Duterte faces a challenge to
the transition from his campaign trail mode, where he had a lot of bumper sticker policy statements, not to be indifferent from that of Donald Trump. He had a very much off-the-cuff kind of rhetoric. So now he has to transition into much more dignified, predictable, less erratic kind of head of state. But so far, I think the picture is mixed. On one hand, you could say that he is indeed transforming into a much more statesman-like, much more pragmatic candidate. I mean, if you look at his choices in the cabinet, particularly his choices for the top macroeconomic portfolios. I'm talking about finance, I'm talking about infrastructure and transportation, I'm talking about budget management. He gave it essentially to technocrats.
And to use a little bit of the American vernacular here, that means Duterte is picking people who are well-known and are either trusted by him, experts, or have even served in previous administrations. So
the cabinet choice tells you that what he's looking at is experience, political loyalty, and also a degree of predictability. So we can see that in his cabinet. Not to mention, 48 hours after his victory was clear in the elections, he came up with an 8-point agenda, which immediately led to a rebound in Philippine stock exchange, a 9-month high. It's because if you look at the 8-point agenda, which was drafted by Sonny Dominguez, who will be the finance minister, it's essentially a regurgitation of the macroeconomic policies of the previous two administrations.
According to the election results, Duterte received about 39% of the votes. So while he did win the election, he didn't win the majority of the votes cast, but merely the most number of those cast. With nearly 60% of the voters casting ballots for someone else, now that they've had a chance to get a glimpse of their new president, have they changed their opinion and rallied behind him? Haydarian notes that during the election, there were only a few members of the Philippine Congress that supported him. But after the results were certified,
now he has 300 supporters in the Philippine Congress. It's because almost everyone has defected to his side, including the ruling Liberal Party. The sense I get with Duterte is that I think he's still in the campaign mode, in the sense that he wants so many changes in the country. He has so much power, but he doesn't know where to concentrate it yet, right? So we'll get an idea of what will be his main priorities, I think, once we see the inauguration speech end of this month, June 30. But so far, what we see from him are these incoherent, long-winded ramblings or slash press conferences that have ended in some sort of PR disaster for him. We still do not see him transitioning fully into a head of state mode. So my idea is, let's wait for his inauguration speech, because it's there that we really get to see what he feels most passionate about and where will he put his political capital in, because he cannot do everything. But there is more or less bandwagoning behind him, at least in the legislature. And you would say, perhaps in the public opinion, but it's hard to gauge the public opinion, because the public opinion also shifts depending on what they see in terms of the coverage of Duterte. And let's be honest, Duterte is quite a polarizing figure.
De La Salle University's Richard Haydarian says that Duterte may even be in a position to unify the country if he chooses to reach out and involve people in his administration that are not part of his core support group. But what about the Philippines' national image abroad? I mean, Duterte is in the press quite often with these missteps in the press. Is Duterte hurting the country? Again, Dr. Patricio Abinales, the director of Philippine Studies at the University of Hawaii in Manila.
if you look at, for example, the reports of the State Department on drug trafficking, on the flow of methamphetamine across Southeast Asia, the Philippines is one of the centerpieces, center points. If you talk about the illicit trade that goes on around the region, from cigarettes to toilet paper to everything, the Philippines plays a very central node in that trade. So there's two ways of looking at the Philippines. You can look at it from the New York Times or Time Magazine and say, my God, once this person comes to power, their image of the country will be tarnished. And then you go into the real side, which is, okay, what's happening in terms of the global illicit trade, the trafficking of women, the flow of opium from say, South Asia, South China, into the rest of the world.
Meaning that while Duterte has some public relations gaffes, he's shedding light on a real problem. So the question then becomes, will his plans be enough to eradicate drugs and crimes and create a country that is as pure and picturesque as the beaches throughout the nation?
No, I'm not sure. I'm not sure, because if you notice his rhetoric, he's going after the small-time drug lords, the small-time criminals. Will he go beyond going after the petty criminals, maybe the city drug pusher, and go after this big family, this big drug lords, armed smugglers, warlords, etc.? And I'm not sure if he can do that.
All right, just one more quick note before I head out the door. Hong Kong student leader Joshua Wong was acquitted on Tuesday over an anti-China protest, and it's the first in a series of cases against him. Wong said that the verdict proves the charges against him were politically motivated. He is currently awaiting the decision on a separate matter regarding a demonstration that saw students climb into the Hong Kong legislative complex itself, and that decision is expected later in June. All right, my friends, that's it for this week. Thank you so much for listening. Now, if you enjoyed the podcast, please do me a huge favor and share it with your friends and family. I'd also love to hear your thoughts and opinions about the stories in this week's podcast. So please hit me up on Twitter or Facebook at Steve Miller VOA, and don't forget about our community Facebook page, VOA Now. To get every podcast delivered to you automatically, be sure to subscribe. It's quick, it's easy, and best of all, free. Just go to voanews.com and click on the Programs tab. On the radio page, look for VOA Asia Weekly and then click on the subscribe icon. Well, that's our show this week. Thank you so much for joining me. In Washington, I'm Steve Miller. And until next time, be true to yourself and always be awesome.